Good morning, church. I want to invite you to turn to the book of Exodus, chapter 1. That's in the Old Testament. If you start at the beginning and just turn a couple pages over, you'll find the book of Exodus. If you go too far and you get to Leviticus, danger, back up. We're beginning a new series for the next several weeks called The Long Walk, a journey with Israel through the Exodus and the wilderness. We're going to be talking about how God shapes and forms his people through journey, sometimes difficult journeys. When I was 7 years old, I had an argument with my mom, and I decided I was going to run away from home. So calling my bluff, my mom said, go ahead. So I grabbed a backpack and a package of saltine crackers and a Star Wars action figure, and I was ready to go. I was ready to leave behind the slavery of chores and sibling conflict and to set out on the open road. I got on my bike and started down the block as the rock anthem by Whitesnake, Here I Go Again on My Own, was playing in the background, at least in my mind later as I think about the story. Journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And so I was off. My journey was filled with hunger and pain and thirst and turmoil. I pedaled that bike for what seemed like years. I battled the elements. And finally, the moment came when after seeing the big wide world, I knew it was time. In the words of Forrest Gump, I'm kind of tired. I think I'll go home now. It was time. I pictured the sweet reunion and the hugs, the embraces of coming home, and so I turned my bike around, pedaled it right back past those 7 houses that I had just gone by in the last 6 minutes, and I came home. If you think about a lot of the great stories begin with a person leaving something behind, a lot of times home. I love all these great stories where Harry Potter has to leave the Dursleys if he's going to become who he's going to be, and Luke Skywalker has to leave the desert planet of Tatooine if he's going to follow Obi-Wan and learn the ways of the Force. Frodo has to leave the Shire if he's going to take up the mission of destroying the Ring. Many times people leave, and it's not like with me where I left a loving home for 6 minutes, but oftentimes in the great stories, people must leave. Something happens in the story, something happens in the world, and they cannot stay the same. They cannot go back. They cannot stay. The only way is the way forward. And so they set out. And that is most certainly the case with the people of Israel. When we come to this part of the story in the book of Exodus, at the beginning of the story of Exodus, we find that the people of Israel are at a dead end and they have nowhere to go. So let's read from chapter 1, starting in verse 8 from the book of Exodus. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramses as storehouses for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The story begins with the powerful taking advantage of the weak, with those who would advance their own purpose and agenda in the world at the expense of innocent people. And across the vast history of time and space in our world, between that time and ours, some things have not changed. How did we get here? How did things come to this? How is it that God's people could become slaves? The story begins in the beginning, where God creates the heavens and the earth. And we read that all things are good and just the way that they're supposed to be. God creates human beings. He creates animals. He creates the world. He creates the stars. All the things that have been made, as we read earlier in our service today, were made through the word of God and for his pleasure. And God gave human beings a mission, a goal, something to work toward, to cultivate the world and to make it the paradise that God always intended for it to be. And as the story goes, and actually we don't need the story to tell us that this is how the story goes, because we know it for ourselves, that human beings, all of us, we choose to pursue life on our own terms. We choose not to live the life and calling that God wants for us, that he calls us to, that he created us to live, and we go our own way, just like Adam and Eve did. And it doesn't take very long before everything begins to spiral out of control. The peace and wholeness and unity and harmony that God had created for all things is broken. And one chapter later, the first two sons of Adam and Eve, the older one, Cain, kills his brother Abel because he's jealous. And it says that his blood cries up from the ground to God. And the story continues to spiral out of control. And again, we could read the story, or we could just look at all of our lives and say the same thing is true. We choose to walk away from God and to do life on our own terms. And it seems like the longer that we do that, the more things spiral completely out of control. By the time you get to the fifth chapter of Genesis, it says that God grieves that he has even made the world. That God is sorry, that God repents, that he has even created anything at all. And so God sends a flood, and he destroys everything and yet saves the world and the animals through one man, Noah and his family. And they come off the ark, and the first thing that happens in Noah's story when he comes off the ark is that he gets totally drunk, showing that even this new start over will be marked by brokenness and fragmentation of ourselves and of our hearts. And from there, the population begins to build, and people start to spread across the world, and things continue to go the way that they've been going, and the whole world just starts moving in the direction that it has gone. And now, thousands of years later, having looked back on history, on things like the Holocaust, and the injustice of slavery, and all sorts of other deep, dark, horrible things of history, we look back and we see where it all began. That the story that God intended somehow goes off the rails. And then we come to a man named Abraham. Because as bad as the story has been, God will not give up on the creation and the world and the people that he loves so much. He will not give up. God is like a relentless, scorned lover who cannot let go. And he pursues his creation and his people and each person. He pursues the whole world, and he will not stop. He will not be satisfied until, as it says in the New Testament, God's desire that all will be saved. And that is God's desire, to put everything back together again. And so he starts with a man named Abraham. And he calls Abraham and he says, Abraham, I want you to leave everything behind, and I want you to follow me into a new story. And this new story is going to take you to a new land, and I'm going to give it to you. And you, although you're old and your body is as good as dead, thanks for the compliment, God. Although your body is as good as dead, I am going to give you and your wife children, and your descendants are going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. And right away, Abraham also shows himself to be a totally messed up person, a liar, a manipulator. And in the 22nd chapter of Genesis, God calls Abraham to lift up even his own very son in sacrifice as a test of faith. And Abraham does it, and God stops him as a foreshadowing of the day when God will handle and deal with all sin and put all sacrifice to an end. And Isaac grows up and he has children, Jacob and Esau, and they have a horrible family. Again, anytime anybody says we need to have biblical marriages and biblical families, I'm like, which ones? Probably not the ones in Genesis, because Isaac is not the best father, and his sons, Jacob and Esau, hate each other. Jacob runs away from home. He steals from his parents. He manipulates his dying blind father, and the story just continues, broken, messed up people. And here we go, and Jacob eventually comes to know the God of his father and his grandfather, and God brings him back, and Jacob has many sons. And one of those sons is named Joseph. And Joseph is Jacob's favorite. And Joseph's brothers hate Joseph. And they throw Joseph in a well, and they sell him into slavery. And Joseph finds himself in Egypt. And so here Joseph is in Egypt, and God, throughout this whole story, is still being faithful to his promise. Even though these people are terrible husbands and mothers and wives and fathers and children and brothers and sisters, they are terrible. They are just like us. No offense. They are just like us. And yet God's purpose does not fail. A famine happens, and all of Joseph's family come to Egypt for food. And God rescues them through his providence and through his divine will. And then generations pass. And before you know it, we get to the opening chapter of Exodus, where a time came when a king arose who did not know anything about Joseph or Jacob or Joseph's brothers. And they enslaved the people of God for 400 years. God's people are slaves. Slaves. How is it that this is not how the story is supposed to go? God's people, God's supposed to protect his people. He's supposed to be on their side. And here we are for 400 years, and these people are enslaved in Egypt. The king of Egypt is so ruthless in oppressing the people of Israel, and he fears their numbers so much that he has all the boys under the age of 2 murdered, ripped from their mother's arms, slashed with swords, and thrown into the Nile River to drown and float away. How did the story get here? Many of us this week have seen the devastating and haunting picture of Alan Kurdi, a 3-year-old boy whose body washed up on a beach in Turkey. He and his family were Syrian refugees fleeing the dehumanizing conditions of their homeland, hoping for a better future. Their journey ended in disaster, with only the father of the family surviving. 3 years old. My son is 3 years old. And as we saw the images this week, we weep and we cry out and we say, God, where are you? This is not how the story is supposed to go. God, do you not see what is going on? And when we do that, we echo the groans and cries of people across the ages. The Israelites themselves in chapter 2, starting in verse 23, the Israelites groaned in their slavery, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. God hears. God sees. God remembers his promise. Last week, many of you filled out an orange card. And although I don't know any of the names associated with the cards that I looked at, I read through so many cards. Fears that we're not getting it right, that our kids won't believe, fears that we don't measure up, fears that we'll be left alone. Feelings of isolation, that nobody else understands what it's like for me to have gone through the things that I've gone through. Sin and secret shame that we carry, the things that we hope above all else that no one will ever find out. And our hope and prayer for healing, that God would rescue us from physical things, sickness, disease, hurt, pain, but also emotional and mental struggles, struggles of our soul that we need God to heal us from. And our hearts cry out to God. And if you had any doubt before last week or this week that there are other people right around you that are also carrying heavy burdens, I hope that you'll know that you are not alone in that. Our soul wrestles with the same questions that I think that the people of Israel wrestled with. Does God hear my cry? Does God care? For many of us, our struggles are intensified because we bear them alone. No one sees, no one understands. Isn't what we long for to be understood? For someone to look at what has happened to us and to say, that's not the way things are supposed to be, and I'm so, so sorry. Does God see this happening? Can anyone do anything about this? Is there any meaning to this? Those are the questions that we wrestle with. So may we hear the word of the Lord, the good news from Psalm 34. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their cry. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to blot out their name from the earth. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. And in Proverbs 15, the eyes of the Lord are everywhere, keeping watch on the wicked and the good. Did you hear that? Whatever happened, whatever that person did to you, whatever thing that you are carrying in that pack, whatever you could not write on the orange card, whatever you cannot and would not and never would share with anyone else, the burden that you carry that no one else can understand because they don't know what it's like to be you and to walk in your shoes, God sees it. God hears it. God knows. Whatever it is that breaks your heart, whatever it is that makes you feel like your head is being held under the water and you cannot breathe, God sees. He knows. You're not alone. God is near. And to me, that's the power in this story, in the opening chapters of Exodus, as we hear the awful, awful situation of the people in slavery. And as we think about our own lives, the things that bring us down, that hold us down, the turning point in the story, the place where God shows up is when the people cry out. When they cry out. Exodus 3. Then the Lord said to Moses, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppressed them. So come, I will send you, Moses, to bring to Pharaoh, to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. What does God do when his people suffer? What does God do when his people cry out? He hears, he sees, he knows, and then he acts. God moves into action. Before this, it's like God has totally disappeared off the scene of the story, and now here we see God entering into the story to get his hands dirty, and we will see in the coming weeks that God will go to war against any force that oppresses the people that he loves. How many times have we looked back on the events in our lives when things have been difficult and we cried out, and now looking back, we can see that even then, in that moment, things that we did not and could not understand were at work. And we made it. I don't know if you have a story like that, but I have so many stories like that, not only about my own life, but about other people that I've known. When we're in the thick of it and we just cannot see the road ahead and we don't know where to go, but later, sometimes years, sometimes decades later, we look back and we see the whole story and we see, oh, God was at work right there. Oh, I did not know at the time, but he was doing this. It's like in a great story when the bad guys seem to be winning and then all of a sudden a good guy shows up out of nowhere and comes to the rescue. When we tell those stories, our stories, we tell all the difficult and ugly parts. We don't just say, you know what, God just always works everything out and so let's just all be happy all the time. We don't do that. We tell our story. We tell the difficult parts. And those are the most powerful parts. Nobody likes a story when you're at a gathering with people and you got a friend that's just like, oh yeah, I'm the best and my life is great and everything's going well and I just got no complaints and here's my story about all the ways in which I'm awesome and everything always goes right in my life. And everybody's like, good for you. The stories that captivate us are the ones where everything goes wrong. Everything goes off the rails. And when we retell those stories, it's those ugly parts that get summed up in a new way, a triumphant way. We talk about all the bad, but we tell it in a way to tell all who are listening that those things weren't the end of the story. The story went somewhere in a new direction from there, and now we're here to tell the tale. And all of that hard stuff gets swept up into a larger story. It gets swept up, gathered up underneath some deeper meaning, some larger story. There's a word for that in the Bible, for all of that that I just described. For that gathering up and summing up of everything under one new explanation that redeems and restores everything that has come before, and it explains it in a new way. And I want you to hang on for a second because I'm going to show you this slide. You're going to see this word. It's 19 letters long. It's a Greek word. Some of you are like, I didn't even know there were 19 letters in the alphabet. Here's the word. Anakephaliosasthai. Let's say that fast three times. No, let's try to say that together. We'll break it up into parts. I want you to say, repeat after me. Anakephaliosasthai. Anakephaliosasthai. Try it. Excuse you. Bless you. It means this: to sum up, to gather up and together, to bring everything under the head and to bring everything into unity with its head. Taking all of the pieces and summing them up and bringing them to a single unity or explanation. This word is used in two places. It's used in Romans to talk about how love sums up the whole law, as we heard about in our communion time this morning. And it's also used in Ephesians chapter 1, in verse 10. I'll start in verse 8. with all wisdom and understanding. God made known to us the mystery of his will according to his good pleasure, which he purposed in Christ to be put into effect when the times reach their fulfillment, to bring unity to all things in heaven and on earth under Christ. What that means is that what God is doing now in the world through Jesus is that he is bringing everything together. He is summing it all up. All the elements of the story get drawn together and make sense when Jesus is the lens. Somehow in Jesus, God is taking all the pieces of the story, of every story, your story and my story, the story of the Israelites, the story of Syrian refugees, and God is taking all the good and all the bad and all the pieces, and he's taking all those things. And he's saying that all of those stories will eventually find their meaning and significance in the great story of redemption in which God is putting everything back together again. That means that even now, right now, at this moment when we don't understand, right now it's difficult. Right now we're crying out. Right now we can barely hang on. Right now we don't have any answers. That even though all of that's true, there is a time coming when our stories will get retold. And in the telling of our story, every piece will get summed up in a new way. That God is reconciling all things to himself, and that even our story, our suffering, was part of the action. I love what author Donald Miller says, that my story is like a tree in a story about a forest. God will take the brokenness and disappointment that I feel, the sin and the mistakes and outright rebellion against God that I have committed. God will take all the things on all the orange cards that have ever been written. God will take the suffering of all people. He will take the hurt and the pain and the questions of why children wash up on shores, and he will take all of that, and somehow, through Jesus, all of that suffering will be placed, has been placed on Jesus on the cross. And that's not just an easy explanation to just explain away the hurt and the pain, so let's all clap and run around and sing songs and just be happy all the time. It is the very real expression of hurt and disappointment in the world, and God takes it all, and through Jesus, somehow it will all be, in the end, a great story of how triumph and love conquers all. And at the end of time, when that story gets retold, and the movie begins to run and play, and we come to the scene of your life and of my life and of our time in the world, and the audience will put their hands over their mouths as they see the hurt and the pain and the disappointment and all the epic failures. And that will be the moment when we were most beat down, crushed, and without hope. When we cried out in the story, that will be the moment when God heard us. And now, here we are. And we've made it. We survived. We came through. As the book of Revelation says, we are the victorious who stand on the mountain of God with the Lamb of God, victorious. At the end of the story, he's gathering up all these pieces and he's putting it all back together. And at the end of all things, all of creation will watch and listen from beginning to end the great story of God. And there in the midst of it will be your story, your chapter, and how you kept going and how you made it. So take heart, my brothers and sisters, because God isn't through telling your story yet. He's brought you this far. and he's not going to leave you behind. I love scenes in movies, and I've talked about a lot about movies this morning. I went all summer, I tried not to talk about movies, so you're getting a triple dose today. We love the moments and stories where someone has been wounded, they're on the ground, and to quote Forrest Gump again, there's a moment in the story when he's fighting in the war in Vietnam and his friend, Bubba, is injured, critically injured. And Forrest picks up his friend and he runs him out of the jungle as the napalm descends on the jungle and destroys everything behind him. And we see Forrest running out of the woods and we see him carrying his friend on his back. And I want you to hear the good news today that God is not going to leave you behind. You have come too far and you have too much good story left to tell in your life. And like the people of Israel, at the exact moment when you feel like giving up, at the exact moment when all you can do, you can't pick yourself up by your bootstraps, you can't go get another self-help book, you can't put it back together, you can't do anything, there's not enough counseling, there's not enough preaching, there's not enough praying, there's not enough anything that has helped, and all you can do is just sit down and cry out to God, God, where are you? Take heart, my brothers and sisters, and know that for all of time, that is the exact moment when God moves into action. You might not see it, you might not know it until the end, but he is at this very moment doing his finest work in you and in me and in the world. So take heart and may you be encouraged. I want to invite you all to stand. May you be bold and courageous. May you know that God is not done telling your story. And if all you can do is cry out, may you know that God is the God who hears, who saves, who redeems, who acts. If you have any need at all as we sing this song, you're invited. You can come forward. We'll have elders in the aisles and up front. If you just want someone to pray a prayer over you, even if you don't want to say anything at all, we invite you to come. I think there's actually still some orange cards left over from last week. And if you want to fill out an orange card and not sign it and just hand it to an elder or a minister or someone around you to pray over those things, I want to invite you to do that. If you have any need at all, I want to invite you to come while we sing. May all of us know and hear the good news and have ears to hear that God is with us. And that he will not leave us behind because he is the God who hears. Let's sing.